Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On June 16th of this year, Daniel Ellsberg passed away at the age of 92. We've decided to depart from our published schedule of morning shows in order to rebroadcast my conversation recorded with Daniel Ellsberg back in 2010. The occasion of this interview was the telecast on the PBS series POV of the documentary film The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. When I pursued the possibility of doing an interview about this upcoming film, I fully expected to be connected with the two filmmakers, Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. Imagine my surprise and delight when instead I was offered the opportunity to speak with the subject of the film, Daniel Ellsberg himself, an invitation which I eagerly and gratefully accepted. Again, this interview aired back in 2010, so you should disregard all references to a PBS telecast of the film. If you are interested in seeing the film, The Most Dangerous Man in America, you should go to the film's website, mostdangerousman.org. There you can get information about the film and information on renting it or downloading it for personal use. By the way, the film is also available on DVD. Here, then, is the uncut, unedited interview, which I recorded back in 2010 with Daniel Ellsberg. Tonight on PBS, on Channel 10 in Milwaukee, a very, very powerful and even haunting, moving documentary airs on the series POV. The film is called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. This is a film which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature for its two filmmakers, Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith, who have fashioned a very, very careful portrait of Daniel Ellsberg and the amazing transformation which he underwent through the 1960s as an advisor to the Pentagon, as his misgivings about the United States' involvement in Vietnam became more and more grave. He was eventually prompted to leak to the public via the press and political figures secret documents from an extensive study which had been ordered of our conflict in Vietnam, of our involvement there. And of course, the result of this release of what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers altered history in ways that Mr. Ellsberg could not have possibly have anticipated. And it's also a very moving personal story as well of what it was like for him, of exactly how his transformation occurred and what this was like for him to live through it as well as his wife and children. And it's an amazing story. And I am nearly struck speechless to say that I have the privilege of speaking with Daniel Ellsberg himself, the subject of this powerful film, again called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I feel very warmly welcomed. Thank you.
I wonder if you could explain. I know that you have penned an autobiography that I have not yet seen, and of course are the subject of this film and its narrator, as a matter of fact. I wonder what the experience has been like to, in a sense, step back in time, and I should think to at least some extent, relive these experiences from so many decades before. On a personal level, what was that like for you?
Well, it is striking. I've seen the film now a number of times. The first one was when it was nearly finished, and I didn't know what it was going to look like from the work. I hadn't had any role in the editing or production of the film except being interviewed. So I really didn't know what slant they would take, and I liked it very much when I saw it. My wife and I enjoyed the fact that they'd chosen to bring out our love story, which was wonderful to relive. I can say that every time I see it, the pictures of my wife 30 years ago, how gorgeous she was, it really reminds me how inevitable it was that I would fall in love with her and the way she is still today. So that's fun to watch. And then other parts of it, I used to just shudder when I would see the bombing coming down and the explosions on Vietnam that had a physical effect on me, and I would twitch and cringe practically as seeing, reliving that. It was a terrible time, really, those years of the war, the inability to stop it, and my knowledge of what it was doing to Vietnam. So reliving that is very unpleasant. But still more anguishing, of course, is to realize that it's happening again in another country. I think it's impossible for anyone to look at those films of the bombing and of the faces of the people on the ground, faces that are rarely seen by the pilots who drop those bombs, and not think of what's happening in Afghanistan and still in Iraq. I think everybody has that reaction.
Before we talk about your story, I wonder if we could just address what is in some ways kind of a mundane matter, but I suspect it's a very interesting question to untie. According to the PBS website for POV, the two filmmakers responsible for this film, Judith Erick and Rick Goldsmith, spent some 6 months convincing you that they were the right team of filmmakers to tell your story. Evidently, they and several other colleagues in the field were sort of in the running for this very exciting possibility. Ultimately, can you share something about your reluctance to have a film made about your story, and ultimately what gave you such confidence that Judith Erick and Rick Goldsmith were the people for the job?
Well, there were several people vying, and it wasn't easy to have a lot of confidence, actually. We didn't know any of them very well, although I knew Ehrlich and Goldsmith both from earlier work, which I thought well of. I participated in two documentaries, they'd done earlier. So I had some confidence in their political perspective, but how the film would come out, I really didn't know. And so I wasn't awfully eager about it, really, to see it done. Earlier, much 30 years ago, there were a number of mainstream films that people wanted to make of it. But in those days, I really didn't want to be perceived as making money out of putting out secrets and being a celebrity or anything like that. So I put that all off. And in retrospect, it might have had a much larger audience if we'd done it earlier, or if I'd written my autobiography earlier than I did. Finally, I didn't really want to go with anybody until I had written a memoir that would have some influence on how they handled it. So it was not until I'd finished that in 2002 that I was ready to entertain people who wanted to do a movie. And as I see, then there were several participants. But we finally settled on Rick and Judy, and without a whole lot of confidence, really. But when we saw the product in a rough form, we were very glad, and we've been glad ever since. Patricia and I congratulate ourselves. We made the right choice.
One thing that I am so struck by, as I watch the film actually repeatedly, is how it is on the one hand a sort of epic story of national policy being waged in something as grand as the Vietnam conflict. I mean, it is that kind of epic canvas on which the filmmakers are painting, in a sense. And on the other hand, it's an intensely personal story of what this was like for you as a person, and for you and your wife and your children, and so a very much a national story and sort of political story, and kind of a thriller in some respects, and yet also this incredibly intimate personal story of these events as well.
Well, that's true. I give credit to the co-directors Ehrlich and Goldsmith for weaving together these three elements so well. If I'd been in charge, probably other things would have been emphasized, but I don't say that it would have been any better or as good, probably as good.
One of the ways in which you were characterized at the time, and even still today, sometimes we read you this story as being one of a hawk transformed into a dove. I wonder, first of all, if you could react to that characterization, and if you think that is simplistic. That is, despite the fact that before these events, and even as these events initially unfolded, you were a consultant for the Pentagon, and you were a U.S. Marine, and ultimately became, of course, this figure very much against the war and how it was being waged. So at least on the roughest sort of level, there seems to be this truth of hawk transformed into dove. But do you find that overly simplistic in the sense that...
Any brief characterization, any two-word characterization is going to simplify things to some extent and to some misleading extent, of course. But it's not wholly misleading. When it comes to hawk, I was a cold warrior. I was not... But there were many people far more hawkish than I. I was very skeptical of air power, for example. I was a former Marine, and although I worked for the Air Force on nuclear war planning, I was a very great skeptic of the efficacy and the legitimacy often of indiscriminate bombing and of heavy bombing. And far from feeling that we really should be involved in Vietnam, I could be called up a hawk as a former Marine and prepared to see interventions in various places, but I was very dubious about the wisdom of being involved in Vietnam right from the beginning, but that was my job and that's where the country was going. On the other hand, I never did become a total pacifist or regret, for example, our country's role in World War II, except for the strategic bombing of cities. In other words, our just war and just cause was marred by some very unjust means in the firebombing of Japanese cities in particular, and in cities like Dresden. But I remain critical of war crimes and of aggressive war. I see our invasion of Iraq as a clear-cut crime of aggression, and one can distinguish that from our early involvement in Afghanistan, where we had at least the color of self-defense going against bin Laden, but where I see the continuation of that war as having no promise whatever and being unjustified and killing people unjustified. So there are distinctions to be made and choices to be made in all these matters. But in general terms, I moved from what could be called a civilian militarist. Some people have been called that, and I fit that. To generally critic of militarism and opponent of it, and without being a total pacifist, someone who believes in nonviolent activism when it comes to changing our country and changing policy and changing the world.
Hmm. One thing we are told of about in the film is that your very first day on the job, once you became a full-time consultant for the Pentagon via the RAND Corporation, was that dramatic events unfolded in Vietnam on that very day. And in many respects, so much of what came after occurred or seemed to occur on your very first day at the Pentagon. Explain to our listeners what happened.
Yes, well, you could say there were the seeds for later change in me in that first day, but they certainly weren't reflected in change at the time. The day that I came on happened to be the day when there was an alleged attack, a second attack on our destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf. There having been an actual attack 2 days earlier on August 1st, and this was now August 4th. And I should say August 2nd, actually, and August 4th. And the alleged attack led to plans for retaliation against North Vietnam, which turned out to be the first bombing raids against North Vietnam, which extended actually right along until 1973. In other words, they went on for 9 years of bombing of North Vietnam. But within hours to days, all of the premises of that retaliation proved to be false to insiders like me. The claim that it was an unprovoked attack was belied by the fact that we were covertly attacking North Vietnam prior to each of these alleged attacks. The idea that it was unequivocal was clearly false by that evening. And within days, it became more and more clear that there had been no attack at all. In fact, that was the case. There was no attack. And it was a matter of false radar and sonar and even line-of-sight illusions that led to the claim. And that was known inside well before Congress was lied into approving a delegation of the war powers to the president in the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. So that night, and even more in subsequent days, as I worked in the Pentagon, I was aware that my bosses, the Secretary of Defense and even the president, were deceiving the public and deceiving the Congress on the basis for a war which I already knew was an extremely unpromising war at best.
You found that even more to be the case once you traveled to Vietnam and saw our efforts on the ground, I mean from the ground, in the midst of our efforts there. And one of the most striking moments in the film comes once you have, I believe, returned to the United States, having just had a long conversation on that plane ride back with Secretary McNamara, in which he seemingly very candidly revealed his grave misgivings about the progress or lack of progress we were making in Vietnam. And then your plane lands and Secretary McNamara speaks to reporters. We see the blurry image of you in the background as he speaks to reporters.
Well, I can tell you that's one of the moments that most made me sit up when I first saw the rough cut of the film and be startled even at the excellence of their research, because I had told them in the interview, in front of the camera, that episode and how I had come down the gangplank after McNamara, just after hearing him say in the plane that things were worse than they had been a year ago, and then hearing him on the ground speak to cameramen and reporters saying, I'm greatly encouraged that by every measure we have, things are better than before, we're making great progress. And I told the interviewers, I thought to myself, I hope I never have to lie like that. Well, as I watched the film, I discovered that they had found the actual footage of that interview, that is, McNamara's interview on the ground, and they actually spotted me coming down the gangplank. There I was. The cameramen weren't focusing on me, but the editors had noticed my face there. And it was quite startling to me, and I suspect to the audience.
Right, and it is remarkable filmmaking. We are speaking with Daniel Ellsberg, the subject of a powerful documentary that airs tonight on the PBS series POV called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Those so-called Pentagon Papers stem from a study, an extensive study, which was ordered by Secretary McNamara. Could you explain why he wanted that study done? He ordered that study to be made?
Still a matter of some speculation. He said at the time to the people doing it that he wanted a documentary study for the benefit of later historians someday. I don't know whether it would be by now or still later, but that someday historians would have the documents together to go over and collect them and they wouldn't all be lost. But the people doing the study, Mort Halperin and Les Gelb, felt that it was essential to do some analysis, pull the documents together, and not just have files of documents, but an account, a narrative that would tie them together. And he approved that. And the upshot then was a 7,000-page study, including several thousand pages of documents, but several thousand pages of narrative and analysis, which were really very well done. And 36 people were involved. I was one of those from the RAND Corporation. Others were military officers on active duty. Virtually, one characteristic was that nearly all of them had been to Vietnam, and some of them, like myself, had also operated at a high policy level. So the current Richard Holbrooke, for example, who's in Obama's, one of Obama's aides working on Afghanistan and Pakistan, had both been in Vietnam and had worked at a policy level and worked on the Pentagon Papers. One of the few, aside from me, who of whom all three things were true. And he's reported now in the new Woodward book that just came out, Obama's Wars, to be one of Obama's aides, among others, who feels that there is no hope, that it's hopeless what he's doing there now. But hasn't said that publicly, needless to say. And in other words, in that respect, he differs from me. I did go public with my conclusions, and as a long-term diplomat and civil servant, he is not.
This study was very carefully shielded from President Johnson, if I understand correctly.
Yes, the fear was that, in particular, his aide, Walt Rostow, who was a booster of the war, promoter of it, would see the pessimistic impression that it gave and would hunt it down and destroy it if he even knew that it existed, more than Johnson himself even. So some effort was made to keep Walt and Rostow from realizing that there was such a study going on.
In the meantime, even ahead of this study, we get the sense that your feelings about the war in Vietnam and how it was being waged were undergoing some change, and due at least in some part to a certain woman you met, first named Patricia, who eventually became and is still your wife. I wonder if you could just speak a moment about the connection between you two and what that relationship had to do with your transformed views of Vietnam.
Well, the movie gives us can give a somewhat misleading impression of the effect that she had in changing me. It is true about the difference of our opinions right from the beginning, because she was a critic of the war right from the beginning, and we sort of overrode that in our early relationship and to the point of getting engaged in Vietnam. But when, as the movie says, she really laid the whole war on me and said, how can you be part of this, very vociferously. And my feeling really was to draw away from that, from her, on the grounds that, you know, how can I marry someone who doesn't give me more benefit of the doubt and a little cut me some slack here. I'm trying to do the best I can to moderate the violence here. And I broke it off, really. Now, there was another woman who is in the movie, and it does say this, but I notice a lot of people don't get the difference when they quote me as saying that a woman had a big influence on me. It probably was the other woman, Janaki Chanaral, who was an Indian, from India, woman who was a Gandhian and is, and who really introduced me to the thinking of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Barbara Deming and others who write in the Gandhian vein, who led more. This was during the 3 years that Patricia and I, my wife of the last 40 years, for 3 years we were fully apart because of having broken up over this disagreement about the war. And it was during that period that I really changed in my attitudes, and it was mainly under the influence of this other woman, Janaki. And eventually, Patricia and I did get together after I'd started copying the Pentagon Papers, and from that time on, we were total partners, and eventually, I told her of what I was doing, and she totally endorsed it and became party of it.
I'm sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
Fortunately, the fact that we participated so closely in it kept us together during the pressures of the trial and the putting out the papers, pressures that really broke up most other relationships in a similar situation. Mm.
Forged your relationship still deeper in some ways.
Yes.
If there is anything that is truly unforgettable in this film, it is when you describe a moment in your life when you encounter someone who really helps you understand what you needed to do in order to act on your growing concerns about what the United States was doing in Vietnam. I am talking about a draft resister by the name of Randy Keeler. And there is even this very powerful moment in the film where the two of you are face to face and you are able to say to him, I have no idea if it was for the first time, but are able to say to him what it meant to you to meet him and to hear his story.
Well, I had told that story before, including in my memoir, but I never told it to him. We've remained friends, but I never went into him with him what the effect was on me of meeting him. And so they asked me to tell the story, or I don't know, they got us into it some way. And it had the effect that it always does on me, the remembering what it meant to me to hear this person saying when I first met him, and he made a very strong impression on me as the best sort of American, somebody I was proud to have foreigners see as they were seeing at this conference, and then to hear him say that he was going to prison, to my surprise, and that's what he felt he had to do, and that he was doing it.
And I was so struck by
it was the right thing to do, and it confronted me with the question, what should I do to help end the war now that I'm ready to go to prison? Because in face of his example, I knew that it was right for him to do it, and it was right for me to risk it.
Your words were something to the effect that this moment of meeting him, seeing him, hearing his story, was a moment in which your life split in two. I thought that was such a striking way to put it. I mean, probably no other words could convey, in a sense, the simplicity and the potency of how much changed inside of you in this encounter.
Well, I see that the film has entered into your mind. You've seen it several times, you say now, so it's gratifying to hear one's own words repeated so closely, but I'm glad it made an impression on you. But it always, when I remember that moment, it affects me very much.
So you make the decision then that the information contained in this extensive study needs to get out. And in the film, we are told of just kind of the laborious logistics of finding a Xerox machine in 1970 or 71, when such things were not nearly so common as they are now,
right.
And of the huge undertaking it was to get this copied. I mean, and just aside from the fact of keeping such activity secret, just to get it done somehow, I mean, I'm so glad that you talk about that in the film, because that's the kind of thing in our day and age now would never occur to us that would even be an issue. It was a very serious issue then.
Well, it makes me jealous when I see the Xerox machines of today that whip things out, many copies very fast, and even do stapling and collating and all that, which was all manual in those days and took months, really. But even more so when WikiLeaks can put out 10 or 100 times as much material with almost a few keystrokes. Although even there, I get the impression that Bradley Manning, who's accused of releasing the video that came out of the Apache helicopter attack, and of so far some 90,000 other cables and perhaps a quarter million state-to-cables still to come, that of course just would have been infeasible. With the Xerox machines of my day, but with digital apparatus, you can do it much faster. And even so, downloading it by his account to somebody else was a very long, prolonged matter, and not the matter of an impulsive moment.
One of the things
I see very much a similar motive and a similar state of mind in Bradley Manning, and I respect what he's done very much.
One of the things you say in the film is that there is something about a document that is particularly powerful and potentially persuasive versus somebody just standing at a podium and talking about what they know.
Yes, or even paraphrasing the documents in a book. I would have expected some of the memoirs that have come out, like those of Richard Clark and a number of others, and now books like Bob Woodward's, to have more effect, given what they're revealing, than they have. And it may be just that we're inured and we don't care about these revelations as much, but I do think that the lack of actual documents does make a difference. As you see in the film, it was a very hard decision for the Times to reach, and they were the only ones really to reach it, to print the actual documents. They were kind of startling. I don't think they do quote Abe Rosenthal, the managing editor of the Times, or the Times, as he said to me, and I think elsewhere, the one time I met him, that when he actually saw the lockup on the lead, as they then had it, the layout of actual top-secret documents from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, even at that late date, he had a shudder of what they were doing, and because the impact is so great. And I'm sorry to see that they don't still do that. And it may be related to the fact that these latest leaks have much less impact. I'd like to see people actually taking the risks of putting out the actual documents, even though it may make their own risk of retaliation greater.
One thing that is also, I think, such a powerful learning experience, something I did not ever know about the story, is that once you release these documents, I mean, first secretly to, well, I don't even remember now who came in possession of them first. Did you first give them to certain members of Congress?
Yes, the Senator Fulbright of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Right. And one of the things that occurred or did not occur, much to your dismay, is that nothing much happened with any of these congressmen who were...
Well, they all said first that they would put them out. And then all thought better of it on reflection, you know, that it was too dangerous for them. Not a danger of prosecution. They knew they were immune from that, but a danger of being challenged and called names and of the administration using that as an excuse not to give them any further information.
Right. So then you make the decision to go to the New York Times. Even then, it is an experience which tries your patience, because the New York Times takes its time to fully digest what you had given them. And
well, the movie gives a somewhat misleading impression on that one because of Hedrick Smith, and he may not have known any different. He talks about me impatiently asking, you know, are they doing it? What's happening? What's going on? He may not have realized that Neil Sheehan was actually lying to me in his responses. He was telling me that the Times wasn't working on them. So the reason I went to Senator Mathias, to Representative McCloskey and others, trying to get them to do it, was that my impression was that the Times was not responding when, in fact, they were working night and day. Why Sheehan took that position, I'm still not clear to this day. But I think he was afraid that if he knew the deadline, knew how hard they were working on them, I would redouble my efforts to get them out through Congress, which I probably would have done if he hadn't told me otherwise and told me not to do it. I would have gone along with that, but I think he didn't trust me to do that.
How long a wait was it between the time that the New York Times gained possession of this material to that dramatic day when they published the first
episode? It was quite a while. It was from early March to June.
Mm.
April, May, June, about 3 months.
And I thought it was so interesting that the film included some of the staff at the New York Times, including their counsel at the time. I mean, weighing very important questions, of course, about what kind of trouble they were likely to be in.
Yeah, if I'd known what they were going through, I would have found it very admirable, and I still do. And I would have laid back and not tried other methods to get it out. But it worked out all right in the end.
Ultimately, of course, an injunction is leveled against the New York Times, halting them in their tracks from publishing any more. Did they publish just one excerpt or one or two?
No, they started out with three, really, before they were stopped. And then about 12 or 13 days later, when the Supreme Court did rule that they were free to go ahead, they went ahead and published another five or seven accounts. Might have added up to 10 or less, a little less than that.
In the wake of that, your tactic is to get this into the hands of other newspapers.
Yes, the reason my wife and I went underground at that point was to use the other copies we had made, thanks to her pressing me to do it, to make sure that other papers were able to publish. And I think without our having made those copies, which I credit her for, she helped do it, without our having done that, the court case would have gone the other way, because if they could have stopped the publication, I think they would have been inclined to do it just to have more time to consider and would have been more cautious about it altogether. But as it was, day after day, one paper after another was publishing. It was clear there was no way they could stop it. The papers were simply defying the government's position on this, rightly so. And they were had the courage to face prosecution and injunction. So they were going ahead, and as one lawyer said, it was like herding bees. There was simply no way for them to stop. And I think under those conditions, we got the 6-3 judgment that the Constitution forbade it. Whereas had they felt they could take time to look at it and just let the more skeptical heads on there, of which there were two or three on the court, prevail, I think it could easily have gone 5-4 against the papers, and we'd have a very bad precedent.
Hmm. You are able to evade capture by the FBI, who were looking for you once the authorities were pretty certain that it was you who had leaked these documents. Can you tell us anything about what it was like to evade capture by the FBI and how you and your wife managed to do that?
Well, the key, we had the help of a number of people who I don't even know, just graduate students generally who were known to each other, who got us from one place to another night after night, and we stayed off the phone. That was the essence of it in those days. Kind of paralyzed the FBI then, as it tends to do now, although their ability to use the internet and email and iPhones and everything improves their surveillance capabilities greatly. But it was possible to do that. I remember at one point, after I had surrendered, having used up all the copies that we had, asking my lawyer, what is the FBI really good at, since they hadn't found us? And he said, taking surrenders. I hate to seem to be provocative of the FBI now, that I may suffer from it, but they looked pretty good during the time later, because they did reach the right conclusion that I had acted essentially alone, except for these people helping logistically. And that was a better judgment than the White House showed. They were sure that it must have high-level conspiratorial help, which was wrong.
One of the things that I appreciate about the film is that although the filmmakers clearly hold you in high regard and hold in high regard the decision that you made to release this information to the public in the way that you did, the filmmakers do allow us to hear the other side of what at the time, and to a lesser extent, but even today, is still a very divisive question of whether or not it was right for you to do what you did. In particular, I want you to respond to one thing said by Henry Kissinger. We hear it twice, actually, in the film, including towards the very top of the film. We hear him in conversation, presumably with President Nixon, saying, "This is an attack on the whole integrity of government. If whole file cabinets can be stolen and then made available to the press, you cannot have orderly government." I wonder to what extent you see validity in what Secretary Kissinger is saying there. And if what you did in light of that was, on some level at least, wrong, but a necessary wrong, or, I mean, help us untangle kind of that moral knot that I think this moment in our history presents.
Well, they would have shown a lot more criticism of what I did if some of the people they asked and urged to speak had been willing to give interviews. For example, General Haig, who is heard on tapes, but he considered for a couple of weeks, having been Secretary of State later and critical at the time and a witness at my trial, he considered giving an interview, but in the end rejected it. So that was true of several other people. So there would have been more critical part on it if people had been willing to give it. As far as the what you did here, I mean, it's obvious that very few organizations would feel they could run their affairs if they did it wholly transparently from minute to minute, you know, under full observation. Not just the government, but corporations and even unions and PTAs or whatever it might be. And I sympathize with that. And it's probably true that they need a degree of privacy in running their affairs. The question is that in matters of war and peace and life and death, accountability is impossible unless the government, the people can eventually discover the nature of their decision-making and hold people accountable. And it is true, I think what they're really concerned for was not that there would be full transparency at all moments. There will always be administrative punishment for that, enough to keep people keeping those secrets and remaining part of the organization. The risk of ostracism, the risk of being thrown out of any organization for telling secrets unduly, is enough to keep more secrets than there should be, generally, very reliably. The real risk is that they were looking at was that it gets very hard to conduct reckless, criminal, wrongful policy without a good deal of confidence that she'll be immune by virtue of secrecy in doing so. And yes, it is very hard, much harder to run aggressive wars, let's say, or criminal conspiracies of various kinds, the more there is a risk of disclosure. That's why the mafia is so scrupulous about killing people who tell their secrets, and why the government indeed has to be so concerned that certain kinds of policy remain very secret. And that's what's true in Vietnam, and it's true right now. It's true in the run-up to Iraq, which I think couldn't have come about. It was such a foolish war, is what Obama called a dumb war when he campaigned against it, and his opposition to it, even without inside knowledge, was critical to his being able to win an election. Well, there isn't any dumber war than continuation and escalation of the war in Afghanistan. It couldn't be dumber. As other empires have found in the past, the Soviets, the British, even Alexander. And it's astonishingly stupid as well as murderous to be escalating our war in Afghanistan the way we are. And I think that the Woodward book that's just come out shows that many people in the administration were able to see that, Holbrook being one of them, from his experience in Vietnam. But not only Holbrook, many generals, his main general, his national security advisor, General Jim Jones, former Marine commandant, his main military advisor on Vietnam in the NSC, General Lute, Lieutenant General, L-U-T-E, and others come through in the Obama book as seeing very clearly that this was hopeless, useless. Lieutenant General Eikenberry, still ambassador in Kabul, seeing that very clearly. And yet we see, as in Vietnam, with all those decisions, with all that advice remaining secret until the a Woodward book comes out, the president finds himself under pressure from generals who are quite willing to leak their hawkish advice, like McChrystal, who leaks through Woodward himself and puts great pressure on the president. So the ones who do leak find that they have undue influence, and the ones who fear their careers will suffer if they leak stay inside, keep their advice to themselves, relatively dovish. And we have a phenomenon that I think of as the silence of the doves, which was true in Vietnam, and it's true now. And the effect of that is that many people die because presidents are afraid to be called names by their hawkish right-wing opponents.
I want us to finish with a final question that may come as a bit of a surprise to you. And again, it's because this is, I think, a surprising element of the film. Alongside all of the dramatic events of history, which we see recounted in this film, is also very much the intensely personal story of you. And at one moment when you are sitting at the piano playing and recount a very sad moment from early in your life, a car accident in which both your mother and sister were killed. I wonder if you could just place that very sad event from your past in the context of all that we have been talking about, or maybe help us understand how that is a part of you, and to whatever extent there is a way to trace that into the decisions which you ultimately made, which ultimately made you such a pivotal man in our country's history.
Well, I think looking back on it, that it did impress on me the possibility that someone you loved and respected, like my father, could, as happened in his case, go asleep at the wheel of a car, killing my mother and sister. My mother was kind of the pole star of my life, in many ways, and the loss of her and my sister meant that anyone could be capable of inadvertence and terrible decision-making, and that I think that it affected my attitude toward even presidents, that those that I most admire could still make terrible decisions, and that you had to be vigilant in trying to warn if you thought things were going wrongly, as I felt I had not done. I didn't have the chance to do it in the car accident, but I did have the chance to do it in Vietnam and yet hadn't done it, partly because I did respect McNamara and I respected Kennedy and Johnson as well at that time when I was working for them. I gave them too much benefit of the doubt, I would say, and when they clearly seemed to be going wrong, I kept my mouth shut. And I think people have done that repeatedly. Did it during Iraq, and are doing it right now in Afghanistan. People who know better are keeping their mouths shut for various reasons, some creditable enough and some not so creditable, just careerist. And that they have to rise above that somehow because so many lives are at stake.
The film, airing tonight on PBS on the series POV, again is called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. We should add that once again, the names of the filmmakers, Judith Eric and Rick Goldsmith, this film, I would say, very justifiably nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. It is a superlative film in every way. And Daniel Ellsberg, I really appreciate this honor in having the chance to speak with you. Thank you so much.
That was a very good interview, so thanks a lot.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, and thank you again for making it possible. Take care.
Hey, so long.
Once again, this interview with Daniel Ellsberg was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. Mr. Ellsberg passed away on the 16th of June. He was 92 years old. And if you are interested in viewing the documentary film about Daniel Ellsberg, there is a website devoted to it, mostdangerousman.org. The film can be viewed via that website, can be rented, and it is also available on DVD. Tomorrow on the morning show, out of the archives, a memorable conversation with someone who was a longtime member of the English faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, the late Dr. Donald Cummings.